A discussion of the play Son of Abraham was led by the playwright Tim McIntosh at the 2007 Summer Institute, entitled Soren Kierkegaard. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Me and the actors afterwards, and it really does matter. I will briefly tell you about the 5 years that I have spent running this play, and that's not an exaggeration. Any of you who have endeavored any sort of, you know, anything creative, sculpting or painting or writing or composing music, at some point you're sitting there and you're wondering, why am I doing this? There are children in Africa who could really use my help right now. There are, you know, there's a friend down the street and he needs things moved out of his house, and I could be doing that right now. I could be making money right now. I could be doing this and this and this and this. And it is so, I mean, if you've been there, it is so lonely. And I cannot tell you how many times I called my girlfriend and I just said, I'm the worst writer. I cannot write my way out of a paper bag. And that's evidence. That's a mixed metaphor. No one can write their way out of a paper bag, you know. And so it's really nice. Last night, I think, was the first time that I really thought, okay, we may be onto something here. This may be a good play. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that as a great sign of relief. My gosh, finally, we may be onto something. And I really thank you for your kindness and generosity. I'm going to tell you just briefly about what I hope to do with the play when I first began. Then I'm going to give a really quick overview of kind of like the highlights of Kierkegaard's life. And then I'm going to go into just a few discrepancies that between his real life and the play, and I'll tell you why those things diverge. First, about why I wanted to write the play, I love Kierkegaard. That's probably fairly obvious. I adore Kierkegaard. Without going into my own conversion story, when the moment that I consciously thought, okay, yes, I am a Christian, I can't believe it. Of all the people that I read, and I read everybody, all the people that I read, Kierkegaard was right. He's the one that I kind of like most identified with. So he's very, very dear to my heart, and I make no apologies for that. When I sat down to start writing the play, I did not want to write an Oliver Stone movie. He is a fine filmmaker, but when I saw JFK or Nixon, I walked out of the theater and I thought, how much of that is real? How much of that is an educated guess? How much of that is just pure fabrication? And I just so instead of when I walked away from the movie, I was thinking more about the sort of historical aspects of it than the movie. And so I was really determined in telling the story of Kierkegaard to be accurate and truthful. But I was not writing a biography. I'm writing a play. I tried to write a biography, a play as biography, and it was both bad biography and bad play. So I was determined to write a good play. That is a very, to stay true to someone's life, a real historical character, and to assure your audience that you, as a playwright, can be trusted, and to still tell the story is very, very hard. In fact, just by way of contrast, if I tried to tell you the story in a play of Abraham Lincoln's lives, there are certain things about Abraham Lincoln's life that you know, that you will expect to see on the stage, and you'll be ready to trust the playwright if the Gettysburg Address is in the play. Because, you know, yeah, I know that about his life. I expect that to be in there. You know that he will be shot in the end. You know, the playwright included him being shot. I know that I can trust the playwright. But with a historical figure like Kierkegaard, who's relatively obscure, invariably the questions are going to come from the audience's mind. How much of this can I trust? You know, how much of this is real? So, anyway, I will boot that answer until the end of my little talk. Now, very quickly, I'm going to give a very, very brief overview of Kierkegaard's life. His relationship with his father, as you can probably tell, by the play. Hopefully you can tell by the play was very, very stormy. He adored his father. He almost worshipped his father. And it is also true that he lost 5 of his 6 siblings and his mother in a very condensed amount of time. The only surviving members of the Kierkegaard family were Peter and Soren, and both of them, coincidentally, this wasn't in the play, believed that they would die before the age of 33 because all of their siblings had died before the age of 33, and that was when Christ died. He died at age 33. So there's this passage when he turns 34 in his diaries that, you know, that he's shocked that he's made it. He did not think that he was going to make it to 34. Peter didn't think he was going to make it to 34. There are stories about Soren growing up with his father. His father was a man of great learning, used to have all sorts of people over to the house, the mayor of Copenhagen, the prince of Denmark, you know, all the luminaries would come to their house, and Kierkegaard, Soren, would sit at his father's side, and his father would say after the dinner party, "I want you to play each of the different parts at the dinner table and tell me what they said during the course of the dinner conversation." I mean, imagine this as an 11-year-old boy sitting there with all, these are the great luminaries of Denmark, and sitting here and saying, "I remember the prince saying this about the economic situation in Belgium. I remember so-and-so saying this," you know. So part of his sort of like psychological nature as a writer, you can see that he's being trained for that by his father. When he was a young man, this just is a little glimpse into his temperament, he sits down to eat his food. All of his siblings are still alive. And he takes up a spoon. No, he takes up a fork. And he takes his plate up and he starts just like shoving it into his mouth like this. And so his sister chides him for this, you know, what bad table manners he has. And she says, "Use your fork properly." And he says something to the effect of, "I don't need to because I am a fork and I will stick you." It's like, he's not afraid of a little tussle, you know. He's not shy at all about this. Excelled, as you would expect, in all things academic. Was kind of cantankerous, you know, as a young man, as you would expect. Goes to university, our equivalent of university, and goes to seminary. And right about this time, about 24 years of age, if I recall correctly, the great earthquake. As he has written in his diary, it is called the great earthquake and will always be referred to in his diaries as the great earthquake. And it is the time that his father calls him into his study and says, "Soren," now remember the background, he adores his father. "Soren, this is what I have done." And it was in the play, if you saw it last night, his father, basically when his father was raised an orphan when he was 11 years old, he went atop a mountain and he shook his fist at God and he blasphemed. And then his father basically returned to a very normal life, left the orphanage, moved to Copenhagen, became a very successful businessman, married a woman he loved, they had 7 children together, and he kind of forgot all about the blasphemy. But then when his family started dying, he remembered the blasphemy, and more of his family started dying, he more and more became convinced that he had committed the only unforgivable sin and his family was going to be punished. He would outlive all of his family and then he too would die. And so Soren learns this. I mean, I can't try to think of a figure in your own life, like the spiritual mentor you've had, if you've had one. And imagine that person telling you basically that the life that he's raised you, that what he's raised you to believe is more or less, in his own life, a fabrication. He's lived not with feeling God's love, but feeling God's, you know, just judgment all this time. And there's also evidence, this is not in the play, there's also reason to believe that he probably told Soren that he had committed adultery with Soren's mother, who was a maid in Michael Kierkegaard, Father Kierkegaard's house, after his first wife died. Does that make sense? Everybody follow that? not everything is crystal clear. All of this information kind of comes through Kierkegaard's imaginative diaries, but most biographers agree that the great earthquake was the confession of blasphemy and probably a confession of some sort of adultery with this woman, Kierkegaard's mother, who was a maid living in the father's house before they got married. And so they married Michael Kierkegaard and Soren's mother. They married, and she was probably a few months pregnant, is what people think. I'm referring to her as Soren's mother. I believe her name is Anne. And you're like, well, how can you know everything about his biography? Kierkegaard almost never mentions her. It's bizarre. I mean, hardly ever mentions his mother. And no one is quite sure why. The guess is that he's just so overwhelmingly enthralled by his father, you know, that he almost just, you know, his mother is almost a secondary figure, which, of course, she couldn't have been. After Michael Kierkegaard tells Soren this, Soren leaves the faith. He walks away, and he lives kind of the profligate's life in Denmark. A few years later, he returns to his father, and when he returns to his father, he returns to God. All of you can put on your Freudian hats right now and, you know, have a lot of fun with that. But, I mean, there's just something going on there that his affection for his father and his, you know, kind of like fear of his father and his father's supposed rejection of the faith is mirrored in his own life and in his return also. He begins, his writing career is basically broken up into three large stages. The first stage is generally referred to as the aesthetic stage, or as we called it in the play last night, it's kind of like the hedonist stage. And when Kierkegaard writes these hedonistic kind of like books, he's writing from the inside. He's writing reflecting on the time that he was just a devout, just a party animal. You know, he just was having a good time. The middle stage of his authorship is the philosophical or maybe more ethical stage of his writing. He really focuses on Hegel. He really focuses on writing more philosophical books. And then the final stage is the religious stage of his writings. I chose to start the play basically at the beginning of the time that he starts writing his religious works. The first two stages are largely written under pseudonyms, really spicy pseudonyms like Constantine Constantius, Father Taciturn, Victor Eremita, lots of dissertations have been written about why those, you know, names. And it's about this time that he breaks with Regina. I will tell you his own reasons for breaking with Regina near to the end of my little talk. He already has a sense that God is calling him toward a purpose, even at this age, you know, his mid to late 20s. He has this sense that God is calling him to something. He doesn't know what it is, but he remarks in his diaries on a couple different occasions that he feels as if he is treading over 70,000 leagues of bottomless ocean waiting for his order, right? And part of the reason that it felt to him like 70,000 leagues is because he did inherit his father's melancholy. I mean, he would probably diagnose him as bipolar today or something like that. He would describe himself as Janus, the two-faced Greek god. Publicly, he was happy and gay and joyful, and privately, he suffered beyond what anybody can imagine. I mean, when you read his writings, his diaries, you have such sympathy for him, especially if any of you struggle with depression. You're like, okay, yeah, that is exactly the way that it feels. And so privately and publicly, he was two very different people, always wanting to reconcile these two things, but he was two different people. I'm going to pause here and tell you about the biographers that I leaned most heavily on and read the paragraph that really made me say, I have got to write this play. I leaned heavily on Walter Lowry's large biography, just called Kierkegaard, about 700 pages, and his smaller biography, A Short Life of Kierkegaard. If you want to read a biography and you don't have the time or the energy for 700 pages, read Walter Lowry's Short Life of Kierkegaard. You can find it at the local bookstore down here. It is fabulous. Also, Peter Groff's Soren Kierkegaard, it's about 600 pages. It was written about 5 years ago. I leaned on Lowry more for like kind of like what's happening in Kierkegaard, what's happening in his interior life, and I lean more heavily on Groff for what's happening in Copenhagen, what's happening in kind of Denmark in the Golden Age. Now, I'm going to read you a paragraph of Lowry's biography. It's about two-thirds of the way through his biography, and he kind of, it's really great when biographers do this, he comes clean. He tells you what he really thinks about Kierkegaard. I mean, he is methodological about giving you all the facts. He knows all the warts. He knows where all the bodies are buried. But now he's going to tell you, this is what I really think about Kierkegaard. So I'm going to read it. Having been so indiscreet as to admit that I'm a lover of Kierkegaard, I would have it known that this is the Kierkegaard that I love. Pause. This meaning the Kierkegaard who is now poised to fulfill his duty, his project, to do what God asks him to do. I would have it known that this is the Kierkegaard that I love. Not the dissolute and despairing youth, not the returning prodigal, not the unhappy lover, not the genius who created the pseudonyms, but the frail man, utterly unfitted to cope with the world, who nevertheless was able to confront the real danger of poverty, as well as the vain terrors his imagination conjured up, and, in fear and trembling, fighting with fabulous monsters, ventured as a lone swimmer far out upon the deep, where no human being could have stretched to save him, waiting for his orders, and then said distinctly that definite thing he was bidden to say, and died with a hallelujah on his lips. I could not love Kierkegaard as I do unless I could venerate him, and I learned to venerate him only when I saw that he had a courage to die as a witness for the truth. And I read that, and I was like, okay, yeah, I have to get to work. And so I got to work. Now, I will briefly give you some of like kind of the main discrepancies between the play and Kierkegaard's life, and then maybe a few moments for questions and answers. Is that right, Wes? Where did Wes go? There he is. Is that all right? We won't go too long. You can just flag me down whenever you want me to stop. Yeah, she is number four. I'm saving the best to last, yeah. Father covered that. Peter Kierkegaard. Soren's brother, he was the only other living Kierkegaard from the family. He was indeed a pastor in the Danish church. Apparently, he was very jealous of Soren. Soren is the youngest brother. Peter was a very intelligent man and probably recognized fairly soon that Soren is someone to be reckoned with. You get the impression that jealousy was kind of the MO of their relationship. Peter seemed very jealous of Soren, and Soren was just not always the nicest guy in the world. You'll just leave it at that. He was not, as he appears in the play, like a mediator between the Danish church and Kierkegaard. There's no real evidence that he played that life. He was a devoted pastor. There's not evidence that he had a really close relationship with Bishop Mainster. But I put Peter in there because I had to have someone who was in the church for all the right reasons. Because Kierkegaard's cry sounds sort of hollow if there's not someone saying, no, we know that the church is corrupt, but still we're involved. Still we're doing it for all the right reasons, you know. The showdown at the end. There's a showdown between Meyer Goldschmidt, the newspaper editor who's standing over here, and Kierkegaard is standing over here. That is a collapse of two distinct events in Kierkegaard's life. Late in Kierkegaard's life, he fought with the newspaper, The Corsair, which is Meyer Goldschmidt's Corsair, which was a satirical magazine, a satirical newspaper. It was kind of full of all the gossip about the celebrities in Denmark. And Kierkegaard just was sort of like, in a lot of ways, he had a martyr's complex, and he did not want the Corsair to praise him anymore. So he writes a letter to the Corsair, and he says, to be praised by the Corsair is the tantamount of just being insulted by, the greatest publication. And he just basically starts a fight with him. It's a little bit of an exaggeration. He just starts a fight. But, he just wanted to tangle. And he wanted to tangle over what the Corsair did, and he thought it was false, and he didn't like the way they were doing things. And so Meyer Goldschmidt, the editor of The Corsair, takes him on, and it got really nasty. It basically culminates in Meyer Goldschmidt writing caricatures of Kierkegaard one of them, the telling one, is Kierkegaard in the middle of kind of a circular universe with the stars and planets and suns revolving around Kierkegaard, the not-so-subtle message being, you know, the guy just thinks he's the center of the universe. There's another one of him walking down Copenhagen with a crooked back because at this point he's very, his spinal disease is kind of bending him over. And there's another one of him, of Regina, of him running piggyback on Regina, kind of like a, you know, just a way of sort of discreetly saying, you know, what kind of a man would leave a woman like this? You know, it's, you know, he's shamed her and all these different things. And though Kierkegaard kind of, you know, played the man during the course of it, you can tell by his diaries he was deeply, deeply hurt by it. Last thing, the most popular question. Everyone wants to know, why did he really leave Regina? The break between them occurred, in reality, about 7 years earlier than it occurs in the play. The main two reasons, according to Kierkegaard, and we have to keep in mind that he is loose with his own biography. He likes to bend things, but there's reason to believe that he's telling the truth here. The two reasons appear to be, one, he did really care about her, and he did know what a torture would be to be married to him. He suffered melancholy. He was back and forth and back and forth. And he sincerely thought, better for her to suffer now and to not live with me than to have to endure me. The second thing is, he already has this sense that it seems that God has called him to something that is antithetical to marriage. So he says, it's even in your anthology, the quote is, there was a divine protest. So I felt comfortable taking the liberty of smashing these two events very close together, because in Kierkegaard's mind, they were close together. He didn't know necessarily what his task was yet, but there, you know, he knew that it was coming. He died, last thing, he died in the street as it was in the play. He was passing out pamphlets. The pamphlets are here, the very last chapter of the book. They are the attack on Christendom. They were not published as a book. They were published as pamphlets, and someone went behind him and gathered all the pamphlets up after he died and published them as the attack on Christendom. Just a couple interesting things about his deathbed. This is another big prompting to write the play. By all counts, the few people who visited him, he did not have many visitors, the few people who visited him said that he was absolutely like as bright as the sun on his deathbed, like as happy as they had ever seen him. So happy that people thought he might be insane. But when you read his diaries, they're not the diaries written on the deathbed of a madman's deathbed. These are a man who has all of his faculties. In fact, I'm going to read the last thing he ever wrote. It is the inscription, if you guys want to read along. It's right before the preface. It's either this, or there's one other little diary entry called The Tame Goose. And they think that either The Tame Goose or this was written last. The messages of both of them are the same. I'm going to start after the first paragraph on the bottom of the two readings, the sacrifice reading. The very right there, see where the preface is? Oh, it's not. You don't have it on yours. Oh, it is. Is that just a different? It's a different edition, I suppose. Oh, okay. All right. So again, keeping in mind, I mean, I had this part in the play for so long, but you know, you make so many decisions, you cut so many great things, and this is just one of the things that I cut. So anyway, I'll read it. And just remember the background. This is a man who's going to die any day, who's lived this terribly sad life, and these are the last words that he writes. Oh, the governance of the world is an immense housekeeping and a grandiose painting, yet he, the master, God in heaven, behaves like the cook and the artist. He says, now there must be introduced a little spice, a little touch of red. We do not comprehend why. We are hardly aware of it, since that little bit is so thoroughly absorbed into the whole, but God knows why. A little pinch of spice, that is to say, here, a man must be sacrificed. He is needed to impart a particular taste to the rest. These are the correctives. It is woeful error if he who is used for applying the corrective becomes impatient and would make the corrective normative for others. That is the temptation to bring everything to confusion. A little pinch of spice, humanly speaking, what a painful thing it is to be sacrificed to be the little pinch of spice. But, on the other hand, God knows well him who elects to use in this way, but then he knows also how, in the inward understanding of it, to make it so blessed a thing for him to be sacrificed that among the thousands of diverse voices which express each in their own way the same thing, his also will be heard, and perhaps, especially, his, which is truly de profundis, proclaiming God is love. The birds on the branches, the lilies of the field, the deer in the forest, the fishes of the sea, countless hosts of happy men exultantly proclaim God is love. But beneath all these sopranos, supporting them as it were, as the bass part does, is the audible de profundis which issues from the sacrificed one, God is love. So, the end. Maybe a couple questions and we can be done. Or maybe I've successfully answered all questions that you have. He was 42. Born 1813, died 1855. They think it was spinal disease. They don't have, obviously, the kind of diagnostic tools that we have today, but it's widely thought to be some sort of spinal disease, spinal cancer, perhaps.
Was that the reason for, in your play, the comments about his neck?
Yeah, and apparently by that time he was severely hunched over. His neck was fairly badly craned, you know, late in his life. He's passing out pamphlets.
And he did take a fall?
Yeah. They found him on the street, I guess late at night, and so it's presumed that he had some sort of a fall, and once he got into the hospital room, he couldn't walk. I mean, he was essentially, he was just severely impaired because of his spine.
So they found him on the street, he wasn't walking aimlessly.
No.
He was on the ground.
He was on the ground. I think he had pamphlets in his hand or on his person. So he was in the middle of doing it.
For his brother, did you portray that his brother really had a sadness at the end, a real understanding, or was the jealousy more? I didn't see the jealousy so much.
Yeah, I didn't bring out the jealousy very much. Peter did the sermon at Kierkegaard's funeral in the church. And it's kind to Kierkegaard, but in a lot of ways it's a very, very political sermon, because here's the enemy of the church, I mean, supposedly the enemy of the church, being buried in the institutional church. And so we don't have much about what Peter thought about Soren, and that sermon is largely basically to keep the peace, and it doesn't say all that much about Soren. So I don't know if there was a whole lot of, I don't know if there was really a mutual understanding there or not.
I think just read recently that actually Peter was banned from the hospital room when Kierkegaard was dying. So it made me curious when you had him be the only person.
Yeah. The person who was with him was a man named Emil Boson, who was kind of like his only real friend at the end. But it seemed fitting, and Kierkegaard refused to take communion from Emil Boson because he was part of the church. And yes, he did not want Peter there. So there is still some sort of animosity. But I put Peter there. It just seemed the obvious and right thing to do, that the brothers had to.
So did he not, when he knew he was dying, he didn't see his brother at all?
I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I can't tell you much about it. There's a little evidence that young seminarians were very upset with what was going on in the church. The best evidence for that, golly, there are so many things that are not in the play that are just so interesting. When Kierkegaard was being buried, there was like a storm of young seminarians, or just young students, who tried to go up to the front and take his casket away. And so that's the biggest evidence that I know of, that there was some sort of real unrest among the younger people with the Danish church, is because they heard Kierkegaard's message and they weren't going to let Kierkegaard, their man, be buried by the organized church. And so the talk about the reform movement, there's a little bit of historical evidence for that, but the idea of them, you know, them passing out pamphlets and stuff like that, it's mainly, I wanted to show that, look, there are people trying to reform the church. That is not what Kierkegaard's trying to do. He's not trying to, you know, get lower pastors' salaries. He's not trying to, you know, get them to spend a little less money here or there. That's not, it's a total, that's just not what Kierkegaard was on about. He was about a spiritual, that Christendom and Christianity as we know it does not exist if we think that what we're doing now is really Christianity. Is that an answer to your question? They were published. So it's funny because I know more about what happened in Europe after that than what happened in Denmark immediately afterwards. He was published in German, and he became very influential in Germany about a generation after his death. And then he started spreading around Europe. But as far as I can tell, and this is the kind of history that's very difficult to put your finger on, I don't know that the Danish church changed. I don't get the sense that it changed much at all. Let me say one other thing about Regina, just because you guys would be interested in this, I think. Regina married Fritz Schlegel, who was indeed her suitor before Kierkegaard came along. Kierkegaard came along and basically kind of threw himself at Regina and said, "I've been waiting for you to notice me." You know, it's very dramatic. And anyway, they break. Regina marries Schlegel. They move to the West Indies shortly before Kierkegaard's death, maybe shortly after Kierkegaard's death. Schlegel is a governor in the West Indies. He becomes sick. About 20 years later, they move back home. They've got children. You know, they've lived, you know, kind of a fairly typical life. And once they move back, everyone in Denmark has suddenly become very curious about Kierkegaard again because he was, you know, an outcast. And, 20 years pass, and people are like, wow, this guy was really on to something here. So Regina comes back, and all these people were starting to want to write Kierkegaard's biography or do some sort of biographical research on Kierkegaard. And so they start showing up on Regina's door, but she's still married. This is very indiscreet. How would he ask about this old lover of hers? Until finally Schlegel dies, and a couple months pass, and then people say, hey, so what'd you think? You know, what was it like? And you know, she was in her 60s by this point, and it's very clear she was always faithful to her husband, loved Fritz Schlegel, you know, very sincerely, but she was still in love with Kierkegaard. It was really kind of obvious that she was still in love with the man. And there's this kind of famous story that she went to a library of a young Danish pastor. There was some sort of party that she was attending or something like that, and she's scanning his bookshelves. And she says, you know, I noticed that you don't have any Søren Kierkegaard here. And he says, who's that? And she says, who's Søren Kierkegaard? You're not fit to be a Danish pastor if you ask who's, you know, Søren Kierkegaard. So, and it's also, she knew, like, she knew who he was going to become. And she also, there's this kind of sense that she maybe knew that she was going to be ushered into history by him. She was going to be sort of immortalized as Regina Olsen, you know, the famous kind of torrid love affair of Søren Kierkegaard. So,
Tim, I'm sorry, are you finished?
Yes, I was finished.
What you alluded to, is it true that he didn't want any of his works fully published outside of, like, the things that he was doing in the newspaper and that sort of thing, or is that not true? Or?
I don't think that's true. I don't think so.
Okay.
Somebody else, yes, and then we'll come over here.
Well, I was just thinking through the years that these different things are written, and I was trying to place when he turns down the offer to become a pastor.
Yeah.
What year was that?
It was very, very late, and it was more of a plan in his own mind than it was something that he pursued it sort of trepidatious, that's not a word, he pursued it with reserve. So I don't know that there was actually an actual formal, there was a formal offer to his to him made sometime when he was in seminary. He didn't really think much about it, though he did preach a sermon one time, but he didn't pursue the life of a pastor until very late in his life. And it was kind of like, well, it's be a pastor or it's do this thing. And so it happened sometime after the writing, shortly after the writing of the postscript. So if you know when the postscript was written, it was within a couple years after that, I believe. Yeah.
So like sickness under death, turning Christianity, that stuff came after death.
Is that right? I don't have the timeline memorized. There's one of these years. One of these years he wrote, it was in the 40s, he wrote 7 books in 1 year, and 3 of them we'd consider like classics. I mean, is it 48? Is that right? Yeah, prolific by anybody's standards. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There was one other event I saw in a little brief biography with Regina that sounded like they had, it was something like they were, she was at a church where he was.
Yeah.
And there was a gesture that she made.
Yeah.
Was it the only resolution they seemed to have?
Yeah. I don't recall how soon it was after their break, but they were both at church together, and he had not seen her for a long time, and she makes a gesture. What type of gesture? Nobody really knows. But he interprets it as, you know, kind of like a possible invitation to take things up again. So this is before she's with Schlegel. And I think it's because he was so tempted to take her up on it that he moved to Berlin. And he moved to Berlin. And he went to here. The big opponent of Hegel was Schelling. Is that correct? And so he went to go hear Schelling lecture for a while because he was like, oh, I can't stand, you know, Hegel. Let's hear what Schelling has to say. And then he ended up not really liking Schelling that much either. And so he came back home. And by then, you know, the temptation had kind of subdued a little bit. Oh.
And I don't know if it was their interpretation or not, but that was supposedly more of a shared understanding that she.
Oh.
At least that's what I got. But it was interesting. I can try to find.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Googled his name and went to a site.
Yeah.
But I thought it might be the one that.
Yeah. It's Wikipedia.
But he had a good timeline for his life on that.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
it was probably a packed timeline. There's somebody over here.
You said in that sacrifice that you read, what you know of Kierkegaard, how accurate would you say that is as a reflection of his life? You know, obviously it's something that he wrote kind of about himself.
Yeah. Of this piece that we read, it just the kind of end things. Yeah. Yeah. I would say it's definitely accurate as far as the way that he viewed his task, and that's almost the only thing that I can say. I mean, how much was he a corrective? I don't know. It'd be a hard question to answer. But he viewed himself, I've told a couple of you guys this story, there's a story in here called What Says the Fire Chief that's in the Attack on Christendom, and it says, it's this parable, what happens if, let's suppose there's a great fire, and all the townspeople show up, and they bring their pitchers of water and their coffee cups and their bowls of water, and they're, you know, pouring it on the fire. And then the fire chief shows up, the man who is, you know, in charge of putting out fires. What does the fire chief do, and what does he say when he shows up this blazing fire? Well, he knocks people down. He puts people on their back. He curses them if he has to. Get out of my way. I'm the fire chief. I will put out the fire. And so it's very much Kierkegaard. It's Kierkegaard's response to, why are you so mean to people even who would agree with you? Or why are you so abrasive? There are lots of people who probably agree with you. You're just taking things to the extreme. And so his view is, well, it is my job. I have to be a corrective. I'm going... If we just view this as something that can be put up with coffee cups and bowls and little pitchers, we've totally understood how significant it is. This is a major, major problem. It's the problem. You know, maybe in Western Christianity, it's maybe the problem. So to be sweet about it is to kind of, you know, make it sound like it's no big deal. Wes, are we done? Yes, sir. No. I tried to find that out, and everyone believes that Dostoevsky was pretty heavily influenced on him, but I don't think there's any, and it's obvious by his writings, but I don't know if there's any journal remarks that he makes that shows that he had read Kierkegaard and that he was influenced by him. It's easier to show with Ibsen. Ibsen was, Henrik Ibsen, the playwright, the playwright of the 19th century, was overwhelmingly influenced by Kierkegaard. And I could reel off 10 other names that you guys know, and they would all count as, you know, heavily, heavily influenced. And Dostoevsky probably was. There's just no real evidence that he was. It just appears so by his writings. Ibsen, Henrik Ibsen, so A Doll's House and The Master Builder, Hedda Gabler. Of course, Sartre, Camus, Heidegger, the kind of existentialist of the 20th century, Karl Barth, the great German theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, deeply influenced by Kierkegaard. And so, just to fast forward a little bit, think about Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Germans living under the Nazi regime who are devoted Christians and who want to take the church away from the Nazi regime, and who do they use... Who do they fall back on for the church to protest the Nazis but our man? I mean, ideas matter, you know? I mean, this is our man they went back to and said, Kierkegaard is yelling from his grave against Hitler, you know? I mean, this is, I don't know, I just think when I think about a kind of like Christianized state or a Christianized society, I don't think happy thoughts, you know? And it's an extreme to say Nazis, but I don't think happy thoughts. And I'm raised in the South. I know what a Christian culture is like. And there are great things associated with a Christian culture. But there are also horrible things associated with it. So, Peter.
Question for you and Jack or anybody else with some background here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who I understood that from. Where did the confusion come in? What happened?
Yeah.
I was just saying, in fact, adding that, I've got a book sitting on my shelf called Seven Men Who Rule from the Grave.
Huh.
And it's Marx, it's Kierkegaard, it's people like that.
Huh.
In Kierkegaard in a negative way?
Oh, really? Jack and I were talking about this at lunch, so I will give you the floor also. My opinion, because I love Francis Schaeffer, and I think he is right on about so many things, but I also love Kierkegaard, and he did not like Kierkegaard, as you said. So I tried to kind of, what's the deal? Why did he think so? And so here's the best that I can do. I'm going to tell a story. I'm going to make it very brief. Soren Kierkegaard, Francis Schaeffer goes to Karl Barth's house. Now, Karl Barth, deeply influenced, the German theologian, deeply influenced by Kierkegaard. Okay, so it's sort of like, yeah, deeply influenced by Kierkegaard. Schaeffer goes and knocks on his house in Switzerland. This is before Labrie begins. Karl Barth invites Kierkegaard, I mean, invites Schaeffer into his house, sits him down in his study, and Schaeffer has a question that he wants to ask Karl Barth. He says, "Do you believe that God created the world?" And Karl Barth says, "Yes, I believe he created the world in John 1:1." So, that's a strange answer, but if you're familiar with Barth, everything is internalized, right? It is all about the existential experience of becoming a Christian. That's a, there's a heavy, heavy influence on that. And so Karl Barth says, yes, he created it in John 1:1. And so Schaeffer's unsatisfied with this, and he points out the window, and he says, no, I mean that world out there. And Barth says, that world out there doesn't matter. Now, if that is a true story, and I think there's reason to believe it's a true story, I kind of take it to mean that Barth has so internalized everything that, like, being involved in creation, in these sorts of things, begin to sort of diminish. And so Schaeffer hears that, and he attributes that largely to Kierkegaard's influence, and he says, I'm done with that project. Now, one of the thing, there was apparently a philosophy professor at a Christian school that invited Francis Schaeffer to speak, and he liked Francis Schaeffer a lot. But he pressed Schaeffer on how much Kierkegaard he had read, and Schaeffer said, I haven't read any. And so it's largely through Schaeffer that we have this negative view of Kierkegaard, and I think it's largely unfair. There are things that we can't agree with Kierkegaard. I think he's overwhelmingly, for the most part, to be trusted. But I think that Schaeffer has kind of shaped him for us in a way that I think he just didn't understand him very well. But, Jack, do you have anything to add to that?
Mm-hmm. And Barth actually was kind of what Schaeffer said that it was. So, Schaeffer in this conversation admitted that he didn't know enough to be able to assess Kierkegaard himself, but he was assessing his impact.
Now, when I read Kierkegaard, and most of it goes right over the top of my head, it seems to me as though often, as I'm reading him, I would have choice of either thinking Kierkegaard is saying Christianity isn't true, or some of what we think of Christianity isn't true. That would be one interpretation. Or the other interpretation would be that Kierkegaard is saying what you think is Christianity, or what the Danish church is telling you is Christianity, isn't true. So it seems to me as though if reading Kierkegaard for the first time, if one goes down the path of saying, oh, well, Kierkegaard is suggesting Christianity isn't true, that brings you down, that sends you down one path, as opposed to understanding what he's saying is your misunderstanding of Christianity isn't true. Now, does that play into how, I mean, does that fit in with what you're saying, Jack, that Camus or some of those folks would read Kierkegaard and say, oh, well, he's affirming that Jesus was not God, or things like that?
with Sartre is that ultimate reality basically is nothingness. And any meaning or any significance or any order or any substance to anything is imposed by you. And so you read that kind of worldview back into Kierkegaard. Truth is subjectivity. Oh, I see. He's just saying whatever you want to be true, you make true by your existential choice and your commitment to it. So that's how I was taught it. And, as an evangelical Christian, that didn't seem like that was going to help me very much.
Anybody else? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sense something else about his, that it also was sort of what he gathered from his father's relationship with God and how he understood him to be angry with him as opposed to having this previous.
Yeah.
That Soren had interpreted his father to be under the impression of feeling loved by God.
Yeah.
You mentioned both those things. And then his response, he said, was that he left Christianity.
Yeah. I'll talk about the first part of what you said first, and he talks about this always very indirectly, but he tells this story. He always is telling parables to explain kind of his inner life, and the parable that he tells is he said, suppose that Solomon, King Solomon, went to go visit David, and he went to go visit him at the palace, and they have this wonderful meal, and, you know, David prays beforehand and blesses the meal, and, he's praising God for the bounty of the table and all these different things. And then comes time for bed, and so Solomon goes to bed downstairs, and David goes to bed upstairs. And in the middle of the night, he wakes up, and he hears someone sobbing upstairs. And he thinks, oh, no, my father's being attacked. You know, someone's after him. And so he rushes upstairs, and he sees his father, but his father doesn't see him, and his father is wailing before God because he thinks that God has judged him, that he is guilty of something that he will never get out from under. Just imagine what that would do to Solomon. So that's the kind of sense that he... And so Solomon would view David's, gray hair not as a sign of dignity and wisdom, but as a sign of kind of like suffered guilt. And so as I understand it, and again, so much of it is piecemeal, but as I understand it, and I think as most of his biographers understand it, that his father was all of the best things about Christianity, and he just inherited his father's faith. When his father told him about this, the blasphemy, and about, if he told him about this indiscretion with his mother, then Kierkegaard understood that, my entire world is just, it's not what I thought it was. And so he leaves, and he's away from the church, and then when he reconciles with father, he reconciles with God. Which of those two things came first? I don't know if it's really clear, but is that an answer to your question? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the playwright talking. No, it's more than the playwright talking. I try to just kind of make allusions to Fear and Trembling, which is his book about Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. And Kierkegaard did not want that story to be watered down and to be told as just kind of like, oh, God just wanted us to offer our best to him. And so I tried to kind of meld, and this is something I'm not sure the play succeeds at, I tried to meld the strict telling of that story, that God was demanding something of Abraham, with Kierkegaard's own sense that his father was basically, had kind of like sacrificed his own son on kind of like an altar of guilt, if it were, because he thought he was going to die because of what his father did. Does that make sense?
Soren
thought that. And Peter thought that. I mean, they thought they would die by age 33. Yeah. And again, it's so, we hear it, and it sounds silly, except for two wives and five children dying in, you know, a span of this long, then it becomes very, very believable. In the early part of the play, it's told as a sacrifice on guilt. But then, if you remember, Kierkegaard is talking to the patient, Mr. Rosted, in his bed, and he says, don't you see, Abraham is not sacrificing Isaac out of guilt. This is a test of his faith. And so I'm trying to get the ambivalence of Kierkegaard's relationship with his father in that, you know, sometimes he felt like he was being suffered on his father's altar of guilt. Sometimes he was the most revered man he ever knew, you know? And so I'm trying to tell both those things, and I know that it's muddled. So in the next version of the play, it's going to be unmuddled. Yes, ma'am. I do not know, but I think he lived a fairly long life, I think. Don't hold me to that. Yes, ma'am. Did you raise your hand? Yeah.
Misunderstood Christianity, or God's love. But then also, if he's concerned that he's going to die because of this curse, then there's that kind of which is he more angry with his father about, that his father has done this stupid thing and therefore it curses upon their family?
Yeah.
Or that his father is like oppressed by his kind of belief.
I think it changes after he passes his 34th birthday and after his father dies. It's more regret. After those events take place, it's more regret that my father lived under this and to some degree kind of raised us under that. But while he still fears that maybe he's going to die by age 33, I think it's just flat out anger that his father would do such a thing, you know. And I don't think it's so much anger as it's just sort of like it's betrayal. It's a sense of betrayal. But his, he says late in his journals that he wants to reintroduce Christianity to Christendom. And why does he want to do that? He wants to do it for his father. So, I mean, he adores his father. And he's, you know, just so betrayed by his father. And it's ambivalent the whole time in his life. It's muddled in the play, and I think it's muddled in his life. Was there one other question over here? Yeah, we're done. Thank you. Yeah.